revelation of the extraordinary Negro complex. We, the half-breeds and the college-degreed, are never so outraged as when a cabbie drives past us or the woman in the elevator clutches her purse, not so much because we're bothered by the fact that such indignities are what less fortunate colors have to put up with every single day of their lives, although that's what we tell ourselves, but because we have somehow been mistaken for an ordinary nigger. Don't you know who I am? I'm an individual. Ironically, racist Americans of all colors would in 2004 begin hailing Barack Obama with all his public intelligence, morality, speaking ability, and political success as the extraordinary Negro. The extraordinary Negro hallmark had come a mighty long way from Phyllis Wheatley to Barack Obama, who became the nation's only African American in the U.S. Senate in 2005. Since Wheatley, segregationists had despised these extraordinary Negro exhibits of black capability and had done everything to take them down. But Obama, or rather Obama's era, was different. Segregationists turned their backs on their predecessors and adored the Obama exhibit as a proclamation of the end of racism. They wanted to end the discourse on discrimination. But, to their dismay, the discourse would not quiet down. Segregationists hardly minded the animalistic black savior flicks, featuring physically supernatural blacks saving whites, The Green Mile, 1999, or the paternalistic white savior flicks featuring morally supernatural whites saving blacks, The Blind Side, 2009, or the flicks depicting amazing real-life stories of personal responsibility overcoming extreme adversity, The Pursuit of Happiness, 2006. But segregationists did mind Paul Haggis's 2005 Academy Award-winning Best Picture, Crash, a film that intertwined the racial experiences over a two-day period of characters from every racial group except Native Americans. Each character is shown as both prejudiced and the victim of prejudice, and the character's prejudiced ideas and actions are depicted as stemming from both ignorance and hate. While segregationists over the years rebuked Crash's explicit racial discourse, and assimilationists hailed the film's masterful portrayal of the pervasive, illogical, and oppressive effects of individual bigotry, anti-racists argued that the film left much to be desired. They critiqued especially the lack of complexity on race relations in the film and the absence of any exploration of institutional racism. In The Atlantic, Ta-Nehisi Coates did not temper his anti-racist review, calling it the worst film of the decade. And for the colorblind segregationists, John McWhorter described Crash as a melodrama, not a reflection of the real America. But it was a devastating natural and racial disaster that summer that forced a tense debate about institutional and individual racism. During the final days of August 2005, Hurricane Katrina took more than 1,800 lives, forced millions to migrate, flooded the beautiful Gulf Coast, and caused billions in property damage. Hurricane Katrina blew the colorblind roof off America and allowed all to see, if they dared to look, the dreadful progression of racism. For years, scientists and journalists had warned that if southern Louisiana took a direct hit from a major hurricane, the levees could fail and the region would be flooded and destroyed, as the New Orleans Times-Picayune reported in 2002. Ignoring the warnings, it was almost as if politicians were hoping for a destructive hurricane to occur so that what Naomi Klein termed disaster capitalism could follow it. Politicians could award multi-million dollar reconstruction contracts to corporations, filling their campaign coffers, and New Orleans's black residents, locked on prime real estate, could be cleared away to make room for gentrification. Whether they actually hoped for something like Hurricane Katrina hardly mattered, because politicos and disaster capitalists, Vice President Dick Cheney's Halliburton, for example, capitalized on the destruction. Even Klansmen got rich off their fake donation websites. It was rumored that the Bush administration directed the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, to delay their response in order to amplify the destructive reward for those who would benefit. Whether he actually did that is unknown, but it hardly mattered because FEMA did delay, and millions suffered because of it. While national reporters quickly reached the city and captured for their cameras thousands of residents of the predominantly black Ninth Ward, trapped on roofs and in the Superdome, federal officials made excuses for their delays. It took 3 days to deploy rescue troops to the Gulf Coast region, more time than it took to get troops on the ground to quell the 1992 Rodney King rebellion, and the result was deadly. "I believe it was racism," said a paramedic who witnessed the death spiral in New Orleans. But even this was not the full story of Hurricane Katrina. The extreme disaster story of racism became an extremely racist disaster story. The Associated Press dispatched a photograph of white people carrying bread and soda from a local grocery store, and another photograph of a black man who looted a grocery store. As babies died of infections and hurt people waited for ambulances, reporters broadcast the sensational stories of babies in the convention center who got their throats cut in a crime-saturated city of armed hordes hijacking ambulances and refugees seeking shelter. Libertarian journalist Matt Welch did not mince words or the truth when he declared that the deadly bigotry of the media probably helped kill Katrina victims. Federal officials and nearby emergency personnel used these media reports to justify their delays, citing the dangers of sending aid and personnel with so many people looting gun stores and shooting at police, rescue officials, and helicopters. Racist Americans actually reported, circulated, and believed the outrageous lies of those who were saying that black people in a disaster zone would shoot at the very people coming to help them. No one summed up the class racism of the government and media response to Hurricane Katrina victims better than Lonnie Gunier of Harvard Law School. "Poor black people are the throwaway people, and we pathologize them in order to justify our disregard," she said. And no one summoned up the raw feelings of anti-racist blacks better than the superstar rapper who had just released his second studio album, Late Registration. "George Bush doesn't care about black people," Kanye West boldly stated, deviating from his script during a live hurricane relief concert on NBC on September 2, 2005. By mid-September 2005, the pollsters were rushing out to check the pulse of American racism. In one national poll, only 12% of white Americans, but 60% of African Americans, agreed that the federal government's delay in helping the victims in New Orleans was because the victims were black. Presumably, the minds of 88% of white Americans and 40% of black Americans, if the poll was representative, had been flooded by racist ideas. In the era of colorblind racism, no matter how gruesome the racial crime, no matter how much evidence was stacked against them, racists were standing up before the judge and claiming not guilty. But how many criminals actually confess when they don't have to? From civilizers to standardized testers, assimilationists have rarely confessed to racism. Enslavers and Jim Crow segregationists went to their graves claiming innocence. George W. Bush will likely do the same. "I faced a lot of criticism as president," Bush mused in his post-presidency memoir. "I didn't like hearing people claim that I lied about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction or cut taxes to benefit the rich. But the suggestion that I was racist because of the response to Katrina represented an all-time low." Into the fall and winter of 2005, anti-racist charges of racism in New Orleans were met with racist charges of the irresponsible use of the race card, to quote black media personality Larry Elder. Into 2006, the producers of racist ideas were arguing that the charges of widespread discrimination in New Orleans and in the United States were fabricated or overblown. The United States was colorblind, and the black people charging discrimination were lying. They were playing their race cards. It was in this polarized post-Katrina racial climate that Crystal Mangum stripped at a party for Duke University's white lacrosse team. After the party in March 2006, the black single mother and college student went to the Durham police. Team members had shouted racial epithets before forcing her into a room and gang-raping her, Mangum told police. Investigators then intercepted and released a post-party email. "I wanted to have some strippers over," Ryan McFadden told his teammates. "I plan on killing the bitches and cutting their skin off while coming in my Duke-issue spandex." As the Durham district attorney filed charges, the case became a national story. The national anti-racist, anti-rape, an anti-sexist community rose up to support Crystal Mangum. Regardless of the result of the police investigation, 88 Duke professors said in a full-page advertisement in the Duke Chronicle on April 6, 2006, "What is apparent every day now is the anger and fear of many students who know themselves to be objects of racism and sexism." By 2007, the case against the lacrosse players had fallen apart. Physical and DNA evidence had exonerated them of misconduct, and revelations of drug use, promiscuous sex, and mental health problems had smeared Crystal Mangum. When it was revealed that she had lied about being raped, everything seemed to turn upside down. The Durham district attorney was fired and disbarred. The players sued the city. Racists and sexists used her case to try to silence the post-Katrina discussion of racism as well as the discussion of rape culture that flowed from her allegation. It was said that Duke's anti-racist, anti-sexist, anti-poverty professors had exploited the case for propaganda. Crystal Mangum's lies were generalized to all black people, all women, and especially all black women. Racists started waving their race cards, explaining that black people had been fabricating and exaggerating the amount of racial discrimination all along. Sexists started waving rape cards, charging that women had been fabricating and exaggerating the amount of sexual violence all along. Gender racists combined the race and rape cards to dismiss the integrity of black women, claiming to be victims of racialized sexual violence. It was as if all black women had done something wrong in Durham, North Carolina. And then the race and rape reformers felt betrayed, especially the men, and they started to belittle Crystal Mangum for setting the anti-rape and anti-racist movements back by giving rapists and racists more of the rape and race cards they loved to play. Her lies would make it more difficult for them to persuade away rapist and racist ideas, to convince whites to acknowledge their racism, and to convince men to acknowledge their rape culture. Ironically, as these reformers condemned Mangum for her folly, foolish tactics of trying to persuade instead of force offenders to stop their crimes against humanity were setting rape culture and racism back. Outside the Marx Hotel in Syracuse, New York, anti-war activists were demonstrating against the U.S. occupation of Iraq. Freezing rain dropped on their heads as they carried on. "You are not fair-weather activists," Angela Davis proclaimed on October 20, 2006. Davis invited the demonstrators to hear her plenary speech at Syracuse University's Feminism and War Conference. Many obliged. Davis lectured on how certain concepts had been colonized by the Bush administration, which had used democracy, for example, in speeches about the need to liberate the women of Iraq and Afghanistan. Diversity had been used by the government, the military, and the prisons to present themselves as the most diverse institutions in history. But the oppressors were hiding behind their diversity and keeping their institutional racism intact, Davis proclaimed. It was a difference that doesn't make a difference. Democracy and diversity were becoming as caustic to the anti-racist cause as race card and personal responsibility. Civil rights activists, however, remained fixated on the N-word, especially after an N-word-laced rant went viral of Seinfeld actor Michael Richards confronting black audience members during a stand-up at Hollywood's Laugh Factory on November 17, 2006. The outrage over Richards's "he's a nigger, he's a nigger, he's a nigger" blended in the spring with the outrage over talk show host Don Imus describing the dark-skinned members of the Rutgers University women's basketball team as nappy-headed hoes. The outrage did not just reflect on Richards and Imus. "It is us," Fox Sports journalist Jason Whitlock wrote in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette on April 16, 2007. "At this time, we are our own worst enemies. We have allowed our youth to buy into a culture," by which he meant hip-hop, "that is anti-black, anti-education, pro-drug-dealing, and violent." At its annual convention in early July 2007, the NAACP held a public funeral and burial of the N-word. But race card, personal responsibility, colorblind, no excuses, achievement gap, felon, and it is us were allowed to live on in the dictionary of racism. "This was the greatest child that racism ever birthed," the Reverend Otis Moss III said in his eulogy for the N-word. "All of the hurricane deaths in New Orleans from the womb of racism, and the N-word was the greatest child?" Months earlier, on November 25, 2006, New York police officers had slaughtered the 23-year-old Sean Bell on his wedding night. Shortly thereafter, the excessive criminal charges against six black high school students in Gina, Louisiana, were announced for their alleged crime of beating up a noose-hanging, racial epithet-throwing white classmate. Days before the N-word funeral, Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts had struck down the efforts of three communities to desegregate their schools, saying that the way to stop discriminating on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. And the N-word was the greatest child of racism? Die, N-word, Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick ordered at the funeral. But nothing was said about racism's other, even more monstrous children. He's the first mainstream African-American who is articulate and bright and clean and a nice-looking guy. Presidential hopeful and Delaware Senator Joe Biden might as well have labeled Barack Obama the extraordinary Negro. Biden's evaluations of his presidential rivals appeared in the New York Observer days before Obama stood in front of the old state Capitol building in Springfield, Illinois, and formally announced his presidential candidacy on February 10, 2007. Obama stood on the spot where Abraham Lincoln had delivered his historic House Divided speech in 1858. Obama brimmed with words of American unity, hope, and change. But Joe Biden's comments, which he later deeply regretted, became a sign of things to come. What was to come over the course of the campaign was a reflection of the audacity of racist minds. From President Bush to radio mega personality Rush Limbaugh to Democratic stalwarts, all to view Obama as an extraordinary Negro. In February 2007, Time magazine speculated that African Americans were expressing greater support for New York Senator Hillary Clinton because of questions over whether Obama was black enough. It couldn't be because they saw Obama as a long shot. It had to be that they did not see Obama as ordinarily black like them, meaning inarticulate and ugly and unclean and unintelligent. Pundits were dubbing Hillary Clinton the inevitable nominee, until Barack Obama upset her on January 3, 2008, in the Iowa primary. By Super Tuesday on February 5, 2008, Americans had been swept up in the Obama Yes We Can crusade of hope and change, themes he embodied and spoke about so eloquently in his stump speeches that people started to hunger. In mid-February, his perceptive and brilliant wife, Michelle Obama, told a Milwaukee rally, "For the first time in my adult life, I am really proud of my country, and not just because Barack has done well, but because I think people are hungry for change." Suddenly, racist ridicule came down on her, smearing her unpatriotic statements, slave ancestry, and brown skin, and tagging her the ultimate angry black woman. Later in the campaign, The New Yorker put an image of Michelle Obama on its cover. She was depicted in military gear and combat boots with an AK-47 across her back, and a large afro topping her head. It was the iconic, stereotypical image of the strong black woman, and she was standing next to her husband in his Islamic apparel. Racist commentators became obsessed with Michelle Obama's body, her near 6-foot, chiseled and curvy frame, simultaneously semi-masculine and hyper-feminine. They searched for problems in her black marriage and family, calling them extraordinary when they did not find any. When the dirt on the Obamas could not be found, investigative reporters started checking their associates. In early March 2008, ABC News released snippets of sermons from one of Black America's most revered liberation theologians, the recently retired pastor of Chicago's Large Trinity United Church of Christ. Jeremiah Wright had married the Obamas and had baptized their two daughters. In an ABC News release, Wright was quoted proclaiming in a sermon, "The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a 3-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America." No, no, no. God damn America for treating our citizens as less than human. Wright had discarded the very old racist lesson that had first been taught to slaves, that African Americans were supposed to love the United States and consider it the world's greatest country no matter how they were treated. On top of his rejection of American exceptionalism, Wright had the audacity to preach that American terrorism abroad had helped bring on the tragic events of 9/11. To put it lightly, Americans everywhere were livid. When Obama's flippant characterizations of Wright as a fraught old uncle did not calm Americans down, Obama decided to address the controversy on March 18, 2008. He stepped into the spotlight and gave a race speech entitled A More Perfect Union from Philadelphia's National Constitutional Center. Having taught constitutional law, worked in civil rights law, and overseen successful political campaigns, including his current campaign, which analysts were already regarding as masterful, Obama could easily be regarded as an expert on many things: constitutional law, civil rights law, Chicago politics, Illinois politics, campaigning, and race and politics. And just as racists presumed that all black individuals represented the race, racists presumed that all articulate black individuals were experts on black people. They presumed, therefore, that Obama's blackness made him an expert on black people. And media outlets routinely brought on eloquent black voices to pontificate on all sorts of black issues they had not been trained in, making the actual interracial cast of experts squirm as they listened. And so, in Philadelphia, many Americans did not see Obama as merely a politician saying what he needed to say to save his campaign. They listened to him, and his campaign aides hoped they would, as an esteemed, knowledgeable, and sincere expert lecturer on race, as someone more credible on race relations than the supposedly angry and old Jeremiah Wright. Obama skillfully took advantage of this platform given to him by racist Americans, and who knows whether he expressed his actual beliefs or calculated that his most comfortable political space was to stand with assimilationists, the group that Robert M. Entman and Andrew Rejecki named the ambivalent majority. These Americans believed that blacks had some strikes against them, but sometimes used that as a crutch. And they were totally unaware that this viewpoint was not only racist, but hardly made much sense. It was like saying that the game was rigged, but blacks should not let that stop them from winning, and that when they lost and complained about the game being rigged, they were using that as a crutch. Obama dismissed Jeremiah Wright's profoundly distorted view, but courageously refused to totally disown Wright. And then he opened his general lecture on race, explaining that socioeconomic racial inequities stem from the history of discrimination. From this firm anti-racist opening, he rotated to the consensus racist theory of the pervasive achievement gap, to the disproven racist theory of the erosion of black families, that welfare policies may have worsened, and to the unproven racist theory that racial discrimination had bequeathed blacks a legacy of defeat. According to Obama, this legacy of defeat explained why young men and increasingly young women were standing on street corners or languishing in our prisons. He ignored the fact that this population was facing the nation's highest unemployment and policing rates. Obama added his legacy of defeat theory to the many racist folk theories circulating in classrooms and around dinner tables and in barbershops about slavery and discrimination, especially its trauma, making black people biologically, psychologically, culturally, or morally inferior. Over the years, people have been using these folk theories, giving them names such as post-traumatic slave syndrome, or the slavery hypertension thesis, or the Hood disease, to walk away from the complete truth that discrimination had resulted in inferior opportunities and bank accounts for black people, and not an inferior racial group. Those anti-racists, Jeremiah writes, their anger is not always productive, Obama continued. Indeed, all too often it distracts attention from solving real problems. It keeps us from squarely facing our own complicity within the African-American community and our condition. It was a classic assimilationist retort, calling anti-racists angry for truly believing in racial equality, for not seeing anything wrong with black people, and for seeing everything wrong with discrimination when squarely facing the African-American condition. Like W.E.B. Du Bois and Martin Luther King Jr. before him, Obama lumped these angry anti-racists with angry anti-white cynics to discredit them and distinguish himself from them. But when Du Bois and King ultimately arrived at anti-racism, they had had to ward off the same angry and anti-white labels they had helped to produce. And now Obama was doing the same thing, unaware that he was reproducing a label that his opponents would stamp onto him whenever and wherever he uttered another anti-racist word after this speech. Obama uttered quite a few anti-racist words in the speech, most profoundly his analysis of how, for at least a generation, politicians had used resentments, fears, and anger over welfare, affirmative action, and crime to distract white voters from the real culprits of the middle-class squeeze, the nation's economic policies that favor the few over the many. But then, ever the politician, he refused to classify white resentments as misguided or even racist. Amazingly, he grounded them in legitimate concerns. Obama ended up following in the racist footsteps of every president since Richard Nixon, legitimizing racist resentments, saying those resentments were not racist, and redirecting those resentments toward political opponents. The doubly conscious Obama encouraged African Americans to fight discrimination, take personal responsibility, be better parents, and end the legacy of defeat. Obama did not offer any child-rearing or psychological lessons for the presumably parentally and psychologically superior white Americans. He merely asked them to join him on the long march against racial discrimination, not just with words, but with deeds, in a chillingly anti-racist conclusion. He left the Philadelphia platform on March 18, 2008, as he began, expressing the half-truthful analogy of continuous racial progression. "This union may never be perfect," he said, "but generation after generation has shown that it can always be perfected." Segregationist and anti-racist critiques were drowned out by the fawning eruption across the ideological aisle. MSNBC political analyst Michelle Barnard framed it as the best speech and most important speech on race that we have heard as a nation since Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And it was not just Democrats who were fawning. Prominent Republicans, everyone from presidential candidates Mike Huckabee and John McCain to the Bush administration's Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, and to the Clintons' old foe, Newt Gingrich, were also praising the speech. The Bell Curve's author, Charles Murray, called it flat-out brilliant, rhetorically, but also in capturing a lot of nuance about race in America. If Barack Obama hoped to transform ABC News's roadblock into a springboard, then he succeeded, soaring into April and May away from Jeremiah Wright and Hillary Clinton, and onto the Democratic nomination in early June. Meanwhile, Republican producers of racist ideas had gotten down to business, demanding to see Obama's birth certificate, questioning whether Barack Hussein Obama was really an American, and suggesting that only real Americans who were white, like McCain, could live in the White House of the United States. No other major party candidate for the U.S. presidency had ever been put under such a searing nativity microscope. Then again, no other major party candidate for U.S. president had ever been anyone other than a white male. The Obama campaign released a scanned copy of his U.S. birth certificate, but the rumors of Obama being born in Kenya or some Islamic anti-American nation did not suddenly go away. They were not started out of ignorance, so why would they go away out of knowledge? But the son of a single mother turned to other matters, like a Father's Day address on June 15, 2008. If we are honest with ourselves, we'll admit that too many fathers are missing. "Missing from too many lives and too many homes," Obama said to a thunderous applause from black hands at a Southside Chicago church. "They're acting like boys instead of men, and the foundations of our families are weaker because of it." The next day, in Time, sociologist Michael Eric Dyson should have buried once and for all the racist exaggeration that Obama and many other Americans kept repeating on this issue of missing black fathers. Dyson cited a study by Boston College's Rebecca Levine Coley, finding that black fathers not living in the home were more likely than fathers of every other racial group to keep in contact with their children. Obama's words may have been spoken to black folk, but they were aimed at those whites still on the fence about whom to send to the White House, Dyson criticized. The legend of the missing black father had become as popular as the legend that there are no good black men. Back in May 2008, Tyra Banks had devoted an episode of her popular television talk show to the topic, calling it, "Where Have All the Good Black Men Gone?" The nearly 1 million black men in prison and the life expectancy of black men being 6 years below white men did not make the discussion. Tyra Banks speculated, sounding the tune of racist black women, that black women were having trouble finding good black men because so many were dogs or dating non-black women or men. In no time, racist black men were saying the same thing about black women. The longest-running number one R&B single of 2010, Alicia Keys's I'm Ready, featured hip-hop sensation Drake, who rapped, "Good women are rare too. none of them have come close. Few good black men plus few good black women equals few good black people equals racist ideas. On November 4th, 2008, a 64-year-old recently retired professor cast a vote for a major political party for the first time in her voting life. She had retired from academia, but not from her very public activism of four decades. She was still traveling the country trying to rouse an abolitionist movement against prisons. In casting her vote for Democrat Barack Obama, Angela Davis joined roughly 69.5 million Americans. But more than voting for the man, Davis voted for the grassroots efforts of the campaign organizers, those millions of people demanding change. When the network started announcing that Obama had been elected the 44th president of the United States, happiness exploded from coast to coast and from the United States around the anti-racist world. Davis was in the delirium of Oakland. People whom she did not know came up and hugged her as she walked the streets. She saw people singing to the heavens, and she saw people dancing in the streets. People, in fact, were dancing on streets around the world, and the people Angela Davis saw and all the others around the world who were celebrating were not enraptured from the election of an individual. They were enraptured by the pride of the victory for black people, by the success of millions of grassroots organizers, and because they had shown all those disbelievers who had said that electing a black president was impossible to be wrong. Most of all, they were enraptured by the anti-racist potential of a black president. Behind the scenes of the exploding happiness that November night and over the next few weeks was the exploding fury of hate attacks on black people. The producers of racist ideas were working overtime to take down some of their colorblind rhetoric that had blinded consumers from seeing discrimination for a decade. They were working to put up something better, a portrait of America conveying that there was no longer any need for protective or affirmative civil rights laws and policies, and no longer any need to ever talk about race. Are we now in a post-racial America? Is America past racism against black people? John McWhorter asked in Forbes weeks after the election. I say the answer is yes.
Epilogue.
Some white Americans who voted for Barack Obama in the 2008 election were post-racial or anti-racist. Others probably dubbed Obama the extraordinary Negro or set aside their racism. If anti-racist blacks could vote for racist Democrats as the lesser of two evils over the past few decades, then surely racist whites could look at the Republican ticket and vote for Obama as the lesser of two evils. To claim that a white Obama voter could not be racist would be as naive or manipulative as assuming that a white person with black friends could not be racist, or that a person with a dark face could not think that dark-faced people were in some way inferior. But white voters did not win the election for Obama, as the post-racial headlines implied or declared. They gave him roughly the same percentage of votes, 43%, they had given his Democratic predecessors after LBJ. Obama's 10% increase in non-white voters over John Kerry in 2004 and the record turnout of young voters won him the presidency of the United States. But racist ideas could have easily lost the election for him. What if Obama had been a descendant of American slaves? What if he had not been biracial? What if Obama's wife looked more like his mother? What if he had not started his lectures to blacks on personal responsibility? What if Sarah Palin had not mobilized Democrats with her virtual Klan rallies where spectators shouted, "Kill him"? What if the Bush Republicans had not had some of the worst approval ratings ever? What if Obama had not conducted what reportedly was the best presidential campaign in history? What if the Great Recession had not sent voters into a panic weeks before the election? Post-racial theorists hardly cared about all those forces that had to come together to elect the first black president of the United States. But when had producers of racist ideas ever cared about reality? The notion of a post-racial America quickly became the new dividing line between racists and anti-racists as Obama took office in 2009. University of Chicago political scientist Michael Dawson, speaking for anti-racists, stated that the country had not yet come close to achieving the status of post-racial, and the evidence was everywhere. The Great Recession reduced the median annual black household income by 11% compared to 5% for whites. On January 1, 2009, an Oakland transit cop killed 22-year-old Oscar Grant as he lay face down with his hands cuffed behind his back. All those geneticists, Klansmen, anonymous internet racists, and of course members of the Tea Party, which formed on February 19, 2009, and other segregationists were organizing like there was no tomorrow after the election of Obama. Between 9/11 and that fateful June day in 2015, when Dylann Roof shot to death 9 Bible-studying Charlestonians inside the oldest AME church in the South, white American Nazi-type terrorists had murdered 48 Americans, almost twice as many as were killed by anti-American Islamic terrorists. Law enforcement agencies were looking upon these white American terrorists as more dangerous to American lives than anti-American Islamic terrorists. But these white terrorists are not on the radar of the hawks who endlessly focus on the war on terror. Americans merely engage in a symbolic debate over the flying of the Confederate flag. Barack Obama had to notice this rising tidal wave of segregationism early in his presidency, years before he had ever heard the name Dylann Roof. Or maybe he didn't, or maybe he did, and thought that to point it out would have been divisive, like Jeremiah Wright. There probably has never been less discrimination in America than there is today, Obama told the NAACP on July 16, 2009. But make no mistake, the pain of discrimination is still felt in America. On that very day, someone in Cambridge, Massachusetts called the police after seeing Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. trying to pry open the jammed front door of his home. When Obama commented that the responding white police officer had acted stupidly in arresting somebody when there was already proof that they were in their own home, when he acknowledged the long history of racial profiling, the post-racialists trounced to stop Obama's anti-racism before it got out of hand. Obama's angry Jeremiah Wright construction had come back to bite him, as similar statements had from Martin Luther King Jr. and W.E.B. Du Bois before him. Obama has, over and over again, exposed himself as a guy who has a deep-seated hatred for white people or the white culture, Tea Party darling Glenn Beck told his Fox News audience. I'm not saying he doesn't like white people, I'm saying he has a problem. This guy is, I believe, a racist. It was a remarkable turn of events. During the NAACP speech, Obama lectured about African Americans needing a new mindset, a new set of attitudes, to free themselves from their internalized sense of limitation, and rebuked black parents for contracting out-parenting. For this litany of rebukes of millions of black people, Glenn Beck and the post-racialists did not offer a critical word. Apparently, it was fine for Obama to demean millions of black people, but as soon as he was critical of a single white discriminator, the post-racialists pounced. Months into Obama's presidency, the post-racialists slammed down their new ground rules for race relations. Criticize millions of black people whenever you want, as often as you want. That's not racialism, or racism, or hate. You're not even talking about race. But whenever you criticize a single white discriminator, that's race speak, that's hate speak, that's being racist. If the purpose of racist ideas had always been to silence the anti-racist resistors to racial discrimination, then the post-racial line of attack may have been the most sophisticated silencer to date. All these post-racialists had no problem rationalizing the enduring racial disparities, the enduring socioeconomic plight of black people, though blaming black people, on Fox News, in the Wall Street Journal, on the Rush Limbaugh Show, on the Supreme Court, and from the seats of the Republican Party. Defending racist policy by belittling black folk, that had been the vocation of producers of racist ideas for nearly 6 centuries, since Gomez Yanez de Zurara first produced these ideas to defend the African slave trading of Portugal's Prince Henry. The post-racial attacks triggered counterattacks from anti-racists, pointing out racial discrimination from Twitter to Facebook, from hip-hop to black studies scholarship, from shows on MSNBC to Sirius XM Progress, and from periodicals like The Nation to The Root, which then triggered counterattacks from post-racialists who call these anti-racists divisive and racist. Assimilationists, stuck in the middle, considered themselves the voices of reasonable moderation. They kept up the drumbeat of the ill-conceived allegory of how far the nation had come and how far it still had to go. The actual American history of racial progress and the simultaneous progression of racism still did not suit their ideology. Through it all, the post-racialists and assimilationists failed to silence all those anti-racists, giving voice to racial discrimination or to make them conform. Anti-racists joined the protest squatters representing the 99% in the Occupy uprising in 2011. They continued to demand reparations, one of the most notable examples being Ta-Nehisi Coates' feature story in The Atlantic in June 2014. They have fought the progression of racism in the stop-and-frisk policing practices in U.S. cities and in the Republican-engineered disenfranchising policies. Anti-racists helped power the unrelenting LGBT fight for equal rights. In the midst of that struggle, black transgender activist Janet Mock released her memoir, Redefining Realness. Held by bell hooks and Melissa Harris Perry and an all-star lineup of other anti-racist voices, Redefining Realness debuted on February 1, 2014, on the New York Times bestseller list. Mock's thrilling and reflective personal quest for womanhood, identity, and love gave readers an opening into the lives and struggles and triumphs of transgender Americans, and especially black transgender women. Somewhere along the way, I grew weary of grasping at possible selves just out of reach. So I put my arms down and wrapped them around me. I began healing by embracing myself through the foreboding darkness until the sunrise shone on my face, Mock wrote in closing. Eventually, I emerged and surrendered to the brilliance, discovering truth, beauty, and peace that was already mine. Anti-racists seemed to be protesting everywhere, especially in front of prisons, struggling against what Angela Davis has struggled against for four decades, the racist criminal justice system and the prison industrial complex. In 2010, Ohio State University law professor Michelle Alexander entitled her bombshell bestseller, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. She exposed racial discrimination at every stop in the criminal justice system, from lawmaking to policing practices, to who comes under suspicion, to who is arrested, prosecuted, judged guilty, and jailed. And when black people leave those jails that are crowded with black and brown people, the slavery ends only so new forms of legal discrimination can begin. A criminal record today authorizes precisely the forms of discrimination we supposedly left behind. Discrimination in employment, housing, education, public benefits, and jury service, Alexander wrote. Those labeled criminals can be denied the right to vote. Michelle Alexander exposed the lie of post-racial America in The New Jim Crow. But nothing really jump-started the traveling exposition of the post-racial lie better than what happened on February 26, 2012, when neighborhood watchman George Zimmerman stared down a trotting black teen, Trayvon Martin, as if he'd stolen something in Sanford, Florida. Scared, the unarmed teen fled. Zimmerman defied a police dispatcher, chased after Trayvon, and ended the 17-year-old's life. A series of events followed, Zimmerman claiming self-defense, protests, Zimmerman's arrest, the murder case, the defense portraying Trayvon Martin as a scary thug, Zimmerman being exonerated, and finally, jurors airing their racist justifications as segregationists rejoiced over the verdict. Anti-racists were upset, and assimilationists were of two minds. This emotional swing seemed to intensify with each police killing, including those of mentally ill Sharice Francis of New York, 22-year-old Rakia Boyd of Chicago, and 23-year-old Chantel Davis in Brooklyn, all within months of Trayvon Martin's assassination. On March 9, 2013, two New York police officers shot 16-year-old Kamani Gray seven times. The violent protests that followed Gray's death and others provoked another round of debates between the post-racial segregationists who condemned the violent thugs the anti-racists, who explained the racist source of the violence, and the assimilationists, who condemned the violent thugs and pointed out the discriminatory sources of their inferiority. For many anti-racists, the term thug had become the accepted way of calling somebody the N-word nowadays. This was how Seattle Seahawks cornerback Richard Sherman explained it in early 2014 after he was subjected to the slur. When the Stanford-educated Sherman shouted into the camera, racist Americans did not see an athlete, fired up minutes after his immaculate deflection that won his team the National Football Conference championship. They saw a thug, like the unarmed thugs officers were killing, and the thugs who were violently rebelling in 2013 for Kimani Gray, in 2014 for Staten Island's Eric Garner and Ferguson's Michael Brown, and in 2015 for Baltimore's Freddie Gray. Thug was one of the many new acceptable ways of calling black people inferior or less than. Other widely used racist slurs and phrases included ghetto, minority, personal responsibility, achievement gap, race card, reverse discrimination, good hair, from the bottom, no good black, and you see, that's what's wrong with black. Hearing the acquittal of George Zimmerman in 2013 punched Alicia Garza in the gut. Seeking relief, she pulled out her phone at an Oakland bar. She only got more upset as she read racist messages on her Facebook news feed, blaming black people for our own conditions. Garza, a domestic workers advocate, composed a love note for black people, pleading with them to ensure that black lives matter. Her friend in Los Angeles, anti-police brutality activist Patrice Cullors, read Garza's impassioned love note on Facebook and tacked a hashtag in the front. Their tech-savvy friend, immigrant rights activist Opal Tometi, came in and built the online platform and hashtag Black Lives Matter was born. From the minds and hearts of these three black women, two of whom are queer, this declaration of love intuitively signified that in order to truly be anti-racist, we must also oppose all of the sexism, homophobia, colorism, ethnocentrism, nativism, cultural prejudice, and class bias teeming, and teeming with racism to harm so many black lives. The anti-racist declaration of the era quickly leaped from social media onto shouting signs and shouting mouths at anti-racist protests across the country in 2014. These protesters rejected the racist declaration of six centuries that black lives don't matter. Hashtag Black Lives Matter quickly transformed from an anti-racist love declaration into an anti-racist movement filled with young people operating in local BLM groups across the nation, often led by young black women. Collectively, these activists were pressing against discrimination in all forms, in all areas of society, and from a myriad of vantage points. And in reaction to those who acted like black male lives mattered the most, anti-racist feminists boldly demanded of America to hashtag say her name. Say the names of black women, victims like Sandra Bland. We want to make sure there is the broadest participation possible in this new iteration of a black freedom movement, Garza told USA Today in 2015. We have so many different experiences that are rich and complex. We need to bring all of those experiences to the table in order to achieve the solutions we desire. When will the day arrive when black lives will matter to Americans? It depends largely on what anti-racists do and the strategies they use to stamp out racist ideas. The history of racist ideas tells us what strategies anti-racists should stop using. Stamped from the beginning chronicles not just the development of racist ideas, but the ongoing failure of the three oldest and most popular strategies Americans have used to root out these ideas: self-sacrifice, uplift suasion, and educational persuasion. Racial reformers have customarily requested or demanded that Americans, particularly white Americans, sacrifice their own privileges for the betterment of black people. And yet this strategy is based on one of the oldest myths of the modern era, a myth continuously produced and reproduced by racist and anti-racist alike, that racism materially benefits the majority of white people, that white people would lose and not gain in the reconstruction of an anti-racist America. It has been true that racist policies have benefited white people in general at the expense of black people and others in general. That is the story of racism, of unequal opportunity in a nutshell. But it is also true that a society of equal opportunity, without a top 1% hoarding the wealth and power, would actually benefit the vast majority of white people much more than racism does. It is not coincidental that slavery kept the vast majority of Southern whites poor. It is not coincidental that more white Americans thrived during the egalitarian movements from the 1930s to the early 1970s than ever before or since. It is not coincidental that the anti-egalitarian movements that followed in the late 20th century paralleled the stagnation or reduction of middle and low-income white salaries and their skyrocketing costs of living. Anti-racists should stop connecting selfishness to racism and unselfishness to anti-racism. Altruism is wanted, not required. Anti-racists do not have to be altruistic. Anti-racists do not have to be selfless. Anti-racists merely have to have intelligent self-interest and to stop consuming those racist ideas that have engendered so much unintelligent self-interest over the years. It is in the intelligent self-interest of middle and upper income blacks to challenge the racism affecting the black poor, knowing they will not be free of the racism that is slowing their socioeconomic rise until poor blacks are free of racism. It is in the intelligent self-interest of Asians, Native Americans, and Latinos to challenge anti-black racism, knowing they will not be free of racism until black people are free of racism. It is in the intelligent self-interest of white Americans to challenge racism, knowing they will not be free of sexism, class bias, homophobia, and ethnocentrism until black people are free of racism. The histories of anti-Asian, anti-Native, and anti-Latino racist ideas, the histories of sexist, elitist, homophobic, and ethnocentric ideas, all sound eerily similar to this history of racist ideas, and feature some of the same defenders of bigotry in America. Supporting these prevailing bigotries is only in the intelligent self-interest of a small group of rich, Protestant, heterosexual, non-immigrant white Anglo-Saxon males. Those are the only people who need to be altruistic in order to be anti-racist. The rest of us merely need to do the intelligent thing for ourselves. Historically, black people have by and large figured the smartest thing we could do for ourselves is to partake in uplift suasion, a strategy as unworkable as white self-sacrifice. Beginning around the 1790s, abolitionists urged a growing number of free blacks to exhibit upstanding behavior before white people, believing they would thereby undermine the racist beliefs behind slavery. Black people would acquire the esteem, confidence, and patronage of the whites in proportion to your increase in knowledge and moral improvement, as William Lloyd Garrison lectured free blacks in the 1830s. The history of racist ideas shows not only that uplift suasion has failed, but that generally speaking, the opposite of its intended effect has occurred. Racist Americans have routinely despised those black Americans the most who uplifted themselves, who defied those racist laws and theories that individuals employed to keep them down. So upwardly mobile black folk have not persuaded away racist ideas or policies. Quite the contrary. Uplift suasion has brought on the progression of racism, new racist policies, and ideas after blacks broke through the old ones. Everyone who has witnessed the historic presidency of Barack Obama and the historic opposition to him should now know full well that the more black people uplift themselves, the more they will find themselves on the receiving end of a racist backlash. Uplift suasion as a strategy for racial progress has failed. Black individuals must dispose of it as a strategy and stop worrying about what other people may think about the way they act, the way they speak, the way they look, the way they dress, the way they are portrayed in the media, and the way they think and love and laugh. Individual blacks are not race representatives. They are not responsible for those Americans who hold racist ideas. Black people need to be their imperfect selves around white people, around each other, around all people. Black is beautiful and ugly, intelligent and unintelligent, law-abiding and law-breaking, industrious and lazy. And it is those imperfections that make black people human, make black people equal to all other imperfectly human groups. Aside from self-sacrifice and uplift suasion, The other major strategy that racial reformers have used is many forms of educational persuasion. In 1894, a youthful W.E.B. Du Bois believed the world was thinking wrong about race because it did not know. The ultimate evil was stupidity. The cure for it was knowledge based on scientific investigation. Exactly 50 years later, in 1944, Swedish economist Gunnar Myrdal echoed Du Bois' teaching strategy in his landmark manifesto for the coming civil rights movement. But instead of teaching white Americans through science, Myrdal suggested teaching them through the media, saying, "There is no doubt in the writer's opinion that a great majority of white people in America would be prepared to give the Negro a substantially better deal if they knew the facts." Du Bois and Myrdal believed, like abolitionists before them, like racial reformers today, that racism could be persuaded away through presenting the facts. Educational persuasion came in many forms. Educators could teach the facts. Scientists could discover the facts. Lawyers could present the facts in cases for upstanding black plaintiffs. Sitcoms and movies and novels could portray the facts of upstanding black folk. At marches and rallies, black folk could articulate the facts of their sufferings before viewers or listeners or readers. Networks and documentarians and reporters and scholars could present factual spectacles of agonizing black folk in their own environments suffering under the brutal foot of discrimination. These many forms of educational persuasion, like uplift suasion, have been predicated on the false construction of the race problem. The idea that ignorance and hate lead to racist ideas, which lead to racist policies. In fact, self-interest leads to racist policies, which lead to racist ideas, leading to all the ignorance and hate. Racist policies were created out of self-interest, and so they have usually been voluntarily rolled back out of self-interest. The popular and glorious version of history, saying that abolitionists and civil rights activists have steadily educated and persuaded away American racist ideas and policies, sounds great. But it has never been the complete story, or even the main story. Politicians passed the civil and voting rights measures in the 1860s and the 1960s primarily out of political and economic self-interest, not an educational or moral awakening. And these laws did not spell the doom of racist policies. The racist policies simply evolved. There has been a not-so-glorious progression of racism, and educational persuasion has failed to stop it, and Americans have failed to recognize it. Ironically, W.E.B. Du Bois abandoned educational persuasion before Gunnar Myrdal's advocacy of the strategy appeared. In the midst of the Great Depression, Du Bois looked out at the United States from the peak of a colossal mountain of racial facts, partially filled with four decades of his books, essays, petitions, speeches, and articles. Negro leaders thought that white Americans did not know of or realize the continuing plight of the Negro, he wrote in a 1935 essay. Accordingly, for the last two decades, we have striven by book and periodical, by speech and appeal, by various dramatic methods of agitation, to put the essential facts before the American people. Today, there can be no doubt that Americans know the facts, and yet they remain, for the most part, indifferent and unmoved. In the eight decades since Du Bois wrote his essay, anti-racist Americans have continued to strive by similar methods to put the essential facts before the American people. There can be no doubt that the producers and defenders and ignorers of racist policies know the facts, and yet they remain for the most part indifferent and unmoved, indifferent to the need to pass sweeping legislation completely overhauling the enslaving justice system, unmoved in pushing for initiatives like fighting crime with more and better jobs, indifferent to calls to decriminalize drugs and find alternatives to prisons, unmoved in empowering local communities to hire and fire the officers policing their communities. They remain, for the most part, unwilling to pass grander legislation that re-envisions American race relations by fundamentally assuming that discrimination is behind the racial disparities and not what's wrong with black folk, and by creating an agency that aggressively investigates the disparities and punishes conscious and unconscious discriminators. This agency would also work toward equalizing the wealth and power of black and white neighborhoods and their institutions, with a clear mission of repairing the inequities caused by discrimination. Lawmakers have the power today to stamp out racial discrimination, to create racial equality as a fact, to quote LBJ, if they want to. They have the ability to champion the anti-racist cause of immediate equality, echoing those old chants of immediate emancipation. They have the ability to turn their back on the assimilationist cause of gradual equality and the segregationist cause of permanent inequality. But local and federal lawmakers fear the repercussions from campaign donors and voters. They know that the post-racialists would reject any sweeping anti-racism bill.